not calling out somebody from my past. It is, in fact, the holiday season, Barry Rose. And we want to wish all of our listeners happy holidays, Merry Christmas, Happy Hanukkah, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Barry, I know you're freezing your ass off in PA. How you doing today, my man?
I'm doing good, Jeff. For a minute there, I was going to play Scrooge, too, and go, bah, humbug. Yeah, it's a weird year for celebration. But, you know, with that being said, I hope that our listeners and they're our friends, Jeff, if anything. They're really our friends, that everybody has a fantastic holiday season. Jeff, what do you have planned this episode dropping just a couple of days before Christmas and Christmas Eve? Give us the full rundown on what the Bowdrin family is going to be doing over the holiday season.
Physical therapy on my show. Oh, no, you mean like holiday stuff. We are going Christmas Eve over to my daughter's house. She is going to be making some brisket. Christmas dinner here at the Bowdrin household, Casa de Bowdrin, is going to be the honey baked ham. Are you a fan of honey baked ham?
I am a fan of honey baked ham.
So we were going to be having some honey baked ham. I'm looking forward to that. And of course, the best part of any honey baked ham is the day after when you have those ham sandwiches. But I digress. So let's talk about episode 168 here of Breaking Kayfabe with Bowdrin and Barry. We are going to be offering a holiday spectacular as we are going to be joined today for a little, you know, Barry, we're just going to sit down by the old fireplace, light up a couple stogies, get a nice glass of Kilvassier, I don't know, brandy, who knows, whatever, and sit down with our friend, the Tennessee Stud, Ron Fuller, and just do a little chatting about wrestling, talking about some stuff. We're going to even ask Ron, I think, about whether or not he likes pineapples on pizza. Put that little thing to rest. And so today, because it's a holiday special, Barry and I decided, do we want to look at Flair Steamboat? Do we want to look at Jack Briscoe versus Dory Funk Jr.? Do we want to look at Rock and Roll Express versus Midnight Express? Do we want to look at some classic five-star match from the past? And I talked to Barry about that, and we both said, fuck no. Let's do someone that we have never covered before on this podcast. In 168 episodes, Barry, we have not once looked at a match from the man they called the original Sheik. Yes, Ed Farhat himself in Japan taking on Abdullah the Butcher. I am not expecting a 60-minute Broadway. What about you, Bear?
No, that I think that's the beauty of it, too, is that you know this is going to be about 10 minutes or so,
yeah,
roughly
exactly.
Right around there.
That's including the intros.
Exactly.
So Barry, short attention span Rose will not have to be worrying about this one. Maybe next week we'll throw in a jumbo versus a 10-room match that goes 60 minutes, and Barry will really have to keep copious notes. So we are going to 1980 as the Sheik takes on Abdullah the Butcher, as they used to say on Championship Wrestling from Florida, Abdullah the Butcher. And we're going to be taking a look at that match. It's a good, fun brawl. We're going to be talking a little bit about the Sheik and about Abby. I'm going to be offering some thoughts from a friend of the show, Fumi Saito, Japanese wrestling historian who I reached out to. Going to be talking about a documentary that was recommended that's currently playing on HBO that I cannot recommend highly enough. And it might be a little bit of a surprise for some of you out there. So, Barry, I'm also going to mention before we get started, just want to say for the record, Barry, what did you have for lunch yesterday? May I ask?
Yeah, absolutely. I had two hot dogs and French fries yesterday.
Okay, that's an incorrect answer because the correct answer should have been a little Lou Malnati's pizza because that's what I had, my man. Yeah, the boys nice. From the Midwest, there's a Breaking Kayfabe round of applause for you guys because I was able to enjoy a nice Chicago deep dish style pie. And it was really good stuff. And so I want to throw out some thanks to my guys, Spiker and Zaha and Brandon New. And
didn't we do this last week? Didn't we?
No, but I hadn't got the pizza by then.
Oh, now okay.
I got to offer my mea culpa.
All right. Go ahead. Yes. So
who am I forgetting? Who am I forgetting? You know?
So Chris Spiker, Travis Reigns.
We mentioned them already. Go ahead. Aaron Grafton. I didn't mention Grafton.
David Jordan.
David
Brandon
Jordan.
New. Was it Jeremy Marshall? I believe was also.
Might have been. Thank you.
Yeah. It's fantastic, though. Wasn't it? Wasn't the pizza amazing?
I got to say, yeah, I was thinking, we're going to get basically a glorified frozen pizza. Not at all. The crust still nice and firm, you know, good solid crust. And I had the. So did you get two of them or one?
I got two.
And have you ate them both yet, or just
one? They were both gone in one sitting between me and both kids, yes.
Really? Okay, so we polished off the sausage pizza yesterday. My wife, with the daughter and her friend yesterday, Bering, are you a fan of hard candy? Yeah, your hard tack, your rock candy, whatever you call it.
I don't know. I mean, I guess it depends.
Well, because my wife was making that yesterday. She made the orange, the spearmint, the cinnamon. And she got some recipe that she pulled off the internet. So they were doing that and they were singing Journey songs. I'm not going to get into that. Singing wasn't very good. There were no Steve Perry. I'm just going to mention that. So, holiday, and the wife made a shit ton of cookies, chocolate chip, chocolate cookies. She's making sugar cookies tomorrow with frosting. So, you know, I'm guessing
Hold on a sec. So I want to get a visual of this.
Sure. Go ahead.
So this occurred.
I'm watching football while this is
going. And this is where that's exactly where the fuck I was going to go with this. You're in the house and you're watching football and you've got three women, one you're married to, one's your daughter's friend. They're making candy and they're singing Journey songs while you're trying to watch football.
Yeah, it wasn't pleasant. You know, keep it fucking down in the kitchen. I'm watching. Of course, the Vikings were losing again. So, you know, but anyway, it was a good time. As I said to the ladies, are you enjoying good fellowship? And they said, of course, yes. So I think I came downstairs and I said, was there a cat being strangled? Because I thought I heard a cat screaming in anguish. So anyway, Barry, now that we're done talking about all that and the holiday preparations, you do love a good Christmas cookie, I'm guessing.
Oh, love it. Absolutely. Yeah, so.
Wife making the sugar cookie with the frosting on it, Barry. That's always a fave of mine come Christmas time. Let's go to our match of the week. We're talking 1980, Abdullah the Butcher versus the Sheik. Now, let me give a little context to this. These two guys were tag team partners in the annual tournaments for years and years. So I reached out to Fumi Saito and I said, Fumi, if you could tell me, like, was the Sheik in Japan the level of a star that Abdullah the Butcher was at this point in 1980. Of course, later into the decade, the Sheik basically stopped coming. Abby became a huge star in New Japan and later back in All Japan again. So what would you say about how big a deal the Sheik was? His response was, both the Sheik and the Butcher were huge stars in Japan since the early 70s. Abby was more of a regular headliner who spent 15 to 20 weeks in Japan every year, while the Sheik was a special attraction superstar who would fly in for a week or two, a tour here and there. The storyline was that Abby worked for Sheik, therefore was placed before, the Sheik was placed before Abby. When this team broke up, both guys stayed heel, which was an interesting twist. The Japanese wrestler who sided with, I believe, Abby was Tork Kamada, and it was Kintaro Oki, a.k.a. Kim Il from South Korea, a huge star from the 60s and 70s. He was the number three student in the Rikki Dozan Dojo behind Baba and Inoki. So that's a little context to the match. So now, Barry, you've had a chance to watch this match. Tell the folks here at Breaking Kayfabe with Bowden and Barry what you thought of this.
Yeah, and we actually, Jeff, we saw Kintaro Oki, Kim Il, in CWF. I want to say it was 1981, I think it was. And it was only for a couple of weeks and he came in. But yeah, kind of interesting. I don't think he worked a lot in the U.S. I believe he was out in Texas working for the Funks at one point, which, of course, the natural connection there of All Japan Wrestling in West Texas. But we got to see him and I didn't recognize him. I'm glad that you actually told me who it was because I wasn't sure who it was. So, yeah, I mean, what are you going to say about this match? You know, you're not going to see a lot of headlocks, wrist locks, arm drag, takedowns, drop kicks, anything like that. This match is exactly what you think. What I did think was funny too, because I don't remember this in later years, but as Abby is making his way to the ring, all the fans are patting him on the head, which I guess was a symbol of good luck or something. I don't know.
Maybe they thought he was Buddha. I don't know.
Yeah, he's Buddha, which he does look like Buddha, right? But I was really, I was really surprised. And Abby was fine with it. I thought for sure he's going to turn around. He's going to chase people. Didn't do any of that, but I thought that was interesting. Match starts exactly like you would expect it. Sheik enters the ring, attacks Abby with a chair. Sheik then whips out the ever trusty pencil that he had for years, starts jabbing Abby in the head with it. Within 2 minutes, Abby is a bleeding like a fountain. You could see all the wrestlers ringside. You happen to catch Kendo Nagasaki, Sakurada?
I did, as a matter of fact. I did see him.
Yeah, he kind of stands out too. And what was interesting was a lot of the boys are all wearing the
all Japan sweatsuit. Track suits. Yeah. Yeah.
Except for Sakurada's not. He's wearing like a blue t-shirt.
Yeah.
So kind of stood out for me with that. Abby then gets the pencil from the Sheik and then starts to stab him in the forearm and then the bicep.
Now, let me just interrupt you real quick. Sure. You stab him with a pencil because at some point he reaches into his boot and he pulls out what looks to be a knife. I don't know, or some kind of a dreaded foreign object. Was that what he used, or was it the pencil he had taken from the Sheik?
Well, I thought it was the pencil that he had taken, but maybe he switched to his own knife at some point. And as you mentioned, Kentaro Oki comes out. He and the Sheik both attack Abby. This is interesting to me because the mutilation of both men with this pencil occurs in full view of the referee. He's got no problem
Joe
with that.
Higuchi. Joe,
yeah, but God forbid Kentaro Oki jumps in the ring. You got to call for the
exactly. Team,
right? Like, you know, like, where's the logic? Weapon, exactly. Fine. Another guy. Sorry, you're out. Tor Kamada, as you said, makes that save. Interesting there as well, because Tor Kamada and Abby had a feud in Georgia, Jeff. And I want to say that was around 75, 76. It was a brief feud. I think it was the Hammer versus Tong feud is what they had actually called it. But interesting that they were on the same side. So a couple of thoughts. This match, there is no surprise here. What's in any form. This is exactly what you think it is. If you want to see, you know, 10 minutes of bloodletting and jabbing with a pencil, that's great. But I did have a few observations, and I kind of want to get your opinion on it. And then I want to share an Abby story as well. But we saw the Sheik in Florida, I guess it was around 1980. I think it was just a couple of months before this match took place. And he had a main event match with Dusty Rhodes on Miami Beach. And I think he was doing the loop. You know, he was facing Dusty in every city. And then he wound up having some brief feud, if that's even the right word, with El Gran Apollo. And El Gran Apollo, you know, I sometimes wonder, a lot's been made about El Gran Apollo physically, looked like $1 million, good looking kid, built like, you know, just tall. It was a tall guy also, was maybe 6'3", 6'2", 6'3", built like an Adonis, pretty good in the ring. But I believe that there were issues outside, and it makes me wonder, of all people that you could have fed to the Sheik, I wonder if what Apollo had done that they decided to feed him to the Sheik. But the match with Dusty went about, literally the Sheik's in the ring, Dusty comes to the ring, the Sheik jumps him, it's 3 minutes, there's a lot of blood, I believe it went to a double DQ and the match is over. And that was the main event that night. It was a big letdown, again, probably what we should have expected, right? It's the Sheik, but at the same time, a 3-minute main event is really, at least in my opinion, that's a great middle finger to people who have bought tickets in any form. So it made me wonder, and Jeff, we grew up watching Florida. You saw Georgia in your time in Georgia, but what if we had grown up in, let's say, Detroit or one of the surrounding cities, or maybe even Toronto, where the Sheik was a headliner for many years. And for whatever reason, we should say, you know, Toronto had this record of, like, you know, sellouts where the Sheik was drawing incredible because people wanted to see him get beat. But at the same time, a lot of these matches were these 5-minute bloodletting matches. I don't think in hindsight, you know, after watching a promotion like Florida, you know, we could take any promotion. You could take the Carolinas, Georgia, wherever. Could you have transitioned? Let's say, so why don't we do that? Why don't we say, Jeff, you grew up watching Florida. You saw these great main events. You got screwed occasionally, as I just mentioned, and your family decides to pick up and move, and you're going to Detroit, and now you're going to go see matches at the Cobo. What would have been your reaction to seeing, you know, a 50-year-old man with limited mobility just doing a blood gimmick and nothing else? Do you think that would have been okay in your eyes? Do you think you would have enjoyed that? Or do you think you would have been like, man, this really fucking sucks?
I think I probably would have been okay with it for a while, just because you have to understand, anybody that grew up in the 70s that was a fan of not just the After magazines, the stuff like Wrestling Review, The Ring, the ones that Lou Sahadi put out, those wrestling magazines, the Sheik was portrayed maybe only on a level of Bruno as far as being a big deal. I mean, you know, he was, how many main event or how many covers do you think the Sheik was on wrestling magazines?
Lots. Lots.
I mean, tons.
Tons.
So this would have been a case where you would have gone to the match. Yeah, the main event was 5 minutes, but you would have seen 5 minutes of complete mayhem and brawling all over the building. And at first that would have, you'd have been like, wow, that was kind of cool. And then after a few shows, you'd have been like, okay, this is what this guy's doing every single show, you know? And he was another guy that I've seen some of his cards that would put like 15 matches on a show, and bell time is 8:30. Right. So you weren't getting any mini 60 minute Broadways from anybody there, you know? So that's the answer to that question. A couple of things about,
I want to ask you another. Okay. So how long do you think it would have taken until you got sick of it?
And, I would say probably a few months.
So you would have made it a few months.
Okay. No, just because he was portrayed. Let's be honest. To compare somebody, I just compared him to Bruno Sammartino. Has always been portrayed as this, this incredible technical wrestler. I'm still waiting to see the first Bruno match where I see technical expertise from Bruno. Because every match I've ever seen, and let's be honest, this was the system of Bruno matches. He would, you know, have the first match where he kind of gets his ass kicked, maybe gets some blood on him. The middle match where Bruno gets his revenge but gets disqualified. And then the third match was the best of, you know, the of the two or three. That's where Bruno gets his revenge and gets the pinfall or the submission clean in the middle. And they worked that system for the better part of 10 or 15 years in New York and Philadelphia and Boston, and it was tremendously successful. But, you know, if you're somebody that grew up watching, you know, Jack Briscoe and Dory Funk Jr. and the likes of those guys, and you go up to New York, that's because I got to be honest with you. Every time John McAdam posts a card from a WWF event, you know, in what's the place that John used to go to in
Witchies.
Yeah. And he'll say, well, this is a strong card. And I'm looking at an 8-match card, and there's maybe two matches that I go, maybe two. And sometimes it's just the headline. And I sit there and go, that poor guy. I bet he wishes he grew up in Florida. So if I moved up to the WWF, I guarantee you after seeing a few Bruno main events where that's exactly what happens, you kind of start figuring the pattern out of what's going to happen. Oh, do you want to go? Bruno's taking on such and such a guy for the first time. Do you want to go see it? No, I'm going to wait until the third of their series because that's when they're going to have the big killer main event. You know, that's the one where Bruno's going to be working a little bit harder, let's say.
Yeah, you know? There was a similar pattern with Dusty in the state of Florida.
Sure.
You have your first match and then, you know, it's a screw job. It's a DQ. The next match, maybe it's a Texas bull rope. You know, Dusty went through the same thing. So, and that you bring up some good points there, because I don't think I've ever heard anybody that grew up in a great territory. Again, let's say Mid-Atlantic, Georgia, Florida, maybe Texas, maybe Houston or Amarillo. And then they move to, let's say, Nashua, New Hampshire, where they have to go see, you know, Silvano Sousa in the main event of a card. You know, and I'm being facetious, obviously, but it did seem like at least the card that you were just referencing, like in Witchies or something like that, a lot of that was preliminary workers that were getting bumped up higher on the card because it wasn't a large town. But I don't recall anybody that ever lived in an area that had really good professional wrestling moving to, you know, the East Coast and going, man, this is great. I'm so happy that I'm able to see this. Conversely speaking, how many people grew up in New York or Long Island or Boston and moved down to Florida? The professor, Pete Lederberg, is one. And when they first saw wrestling down in Florida, they were just like, this is the greatest fucking thing ever. You know, so there is this pride that we have, which we know, you know, look, my territory was the best. And even though, you know, it's 35, 40 and 50 years later, I think that pride still exists. But, you know, I remember the first time we went over Pete's house and Pete was the first one in our neighborhood. And it really wasn't even in my neighborhood that had cable. And he was getting the monthly MSG shows from Madison Square Garden. And I was so excited on this Monday night. A friend of mine and myself, we drove up to Pete's house to watch a card. And I got to tell you, to say that I was disappointed is probably a huge understatement. It was just a completely different style of wrestling, but it was really, really boring. And what I've heard is, you know, the Bruno thing is, I think Bruno was a guy much like Dusty Rhodes that really connected with the audience. He was every man. He was humble. He was a good guy. And he had this charisma about him.
Sure. But, no, that's absolutely true.
Yeah, exactly. But I think what I've heard is that, you know, from people like the Valiant Brothers, and I've heard this, you know, people would say the Valiant Brothers are one of the greatest tag teams of all time. Well, I got to tell you, and I want, you know, I want to say that they are, but I also want to be really honest, and I don't see it. And hopefully I get people who disagree with me so we can lead this into a conversation. But I saw the Valiant Brothers wrestle not only up in New York, whether it was, and I don't think I ever saw them live in New York, but I would have seen them through the magic of either cable television or videotape. But they were down in Florida. We saw them at the Orange Bowl show, but they also came and worked a few matches. And I got to tell you, their style did not translate. And I hate to say this, it came off as too phony when they came down. Johnny especially was just, you know, it just, whatever he was doing, his style didn't translate to Florida, and they didn't get over. And Johnny, after the Valiant Brothers broke up, Johnny came down, Jeff, in 1980 as a singles. And I can tell you, he was slated to win the Florida title. And after 2 weeks, they gave up on him, and he was working prelims. And after 4 weeks, he was gone out of the state. It was that quick. So
let me ask you.
Sure.
I know that Bruno would make shows like, you know, during the holidays or whatever, or, you know, when he would go on a vacation, he would come down and work a few shows. Did you see Bruno in Florida?
No. So Bruno there were two shows that he came down. One was Christmas Day, 1964. So I would have been a little over a year. Didn't go to that one.
Don't remember that show?
Parents fucked me on that one, Jeff. They should have taken me on Christmas to see Bruno at the convention center. The other one was, it was late 74. I think it was January 1st, 75, actually. And it was in St. Petersburg, and he wrestled Tanaka and beat Tanaka. And I didn't go to that. I never saw him work in Florida. And I want to say somebody said, and I don't remember who it was, somebody said, well, when it could have been your boy Flaherty, that when Bruno was here, he worked a different style. You know, that's a stretch. If you're only working two matches over a 25-year period or whatever that time frame is, it's hard to say that he came down with a different style, you know?
So, well, let me ask you then. Okay, so I want to say 75, 76, around then, we had the team of Gino Brito and Tony Parisi come down. Now, did you see them?
So we never had Gino. We had Dominic DiNucci.
Oh, okay. That's who I meant. I'm sorry.
Yeah, I did see him. They were Florida tag team champions, actually feuded with Professor Tanaka and Dick Slater over those titles.
So how did they come off wrestling in the Florida rings?
So you got to remember, I'm going off of what a 10-year-old sees when he sits ringside, 10 or 11-year-old. And I think they were fine. I don't remember anything positive or negative, but I remember liking Parisi and not thinking as much about DiNucci. But again, I was a kid. I don't know. I think the reaction was fine. I mean, I think, and that's the base, not what I think. At the end of the day, how does a crowd react to guys in the ring?
10-year-old Barry Rose wasn't looking over at a slightly older Pete Lederberg and going, right. Hey, Kiese, good world, Lee Zerker. Yeah, okay.
We had Kenny Chastain next to us, right. Inside reference, Jeff.
Of course. With his bottle of Jack Daniels.
Jack. And I was only 10, but we were getting drunk. Now, that none of this was happening. But I don't remember. Yeah, exactly. In a Slurpee, which I was famous for. And actually, Pete didn't come down for about 2.5 years. Pete was down in late 76 when he made the transition from New York down. But I got to tell you, Parisi, I thought, because even though they were tag champs, I think Parisi stayed a little longer and was working singles. And I thought he was fine. I don't remember any issues. I will tell you, I think it was Ole Anderson's book, which is a very interesting book, very interesting read. Ole talks about when he took over Georgia and he had to fire several wrestlers. Parisi was one of them. And I think he called him into the office and just basically just fired him and let him go. So assuming that, you know, whatever style he was working wasn't the style that Ole wanted. But think of all the guys, too, that did come from New York that actually got over. I think Tanaka was a good example. And Tanaka, I don't know if he was a New York guy. I don't know if that's fair. I would have categorized the Valiant Brothers as New York guys. And I got to tell you, Jeff, they not only did they not get over, their matches were underwhelmingly unimpressive, like just did not.
And so anyway, so we kind of got off on a tangent there.
Of course
we did. Guys. Hard to believe, I know. So. let's get back to the Sheik and his. So the Sheik had a run, unbelievably, Barry, of close to 50 years in the ring. And I was trying to remember guys who had runs that long. And the first one that came to mind is like Freddie Blassie, because I think Blassie started in 39 and he wrestled up until like 83 or 84. He had a gimmick match with Lou Albano, I think, and because I remember that won the Observer's Worst Match of the Year award. Maybe Terry or Dory wrestled in that many decades.
So Terry started in Terry and Dory both started in the 60s. And the truth is, you know, Dory apparently was still, I don't know if wrestling's the right word, but he was still performing in rings last year. I'm going to give you two names, Jeff, that I think really reach the longevity as top guys. And one would be Johnny Walker, Mr. Wrestling 2. Here's a guy that started in the late 40s. And in the 80s, he was in the WWE. And granted, they were enhancing him. But in the early 80s, he was still national champion in Georgia. So he was still a guy that he had a run of essentially 30 years. Interesting about Mr. Wrestling 2, though, Johnny Walker, is that he was never really a top draw until that mask came on. And, you know, as Johnny Walker, he had runs. He, you know, excellent wrestler, not an issue with that, but never really got put in that real money-making position until the mask went on. But here's the name, Jeff, that I think is, and this is where I say, I wonder if you can make a case for one of the greats of all time, and certainly his name comes up, but Johnny Valentine. And Johnny Valentine started wrestling in the 1940s. Johnny Valentine's first appearance in the state of Florida as a wrestler was around 48, 49. Johnny Valentine in 1975 was facing Jack Briscoe for the world title. So you've got a space of drawing on top in the state of Florida of 26, 27 years. And not a guy that was working his way down the card. He was still the main event fucking guy in the 70s. That to me is incredible. Had Johnny Valentine not gotten in that plane crash that ended his career, how many more years do you think he could have gone on for, Jeff?
Yeah, and Lou pointing out the name Bull Curry, which is another guy that had a tremendous
30s. Main event. Yeah.
You know, he may have been the guy that originated the whole concept of what we now call extreme wrestling, you know, with the chairs and the tables and all that kind of stuff. But, you know, and certainly the Sheik was a guy that was one of the forerunners of that. He was originally billed as the Sheik of Araby. And of course, in actuality, was just plain old Ed Farhat from Michigan. Interesting. If you've ever had a chance to see the movie, I Like to Hurt People. It's really one of the great kitschy, fun movies to watch. The fact that his family at home could not address him as Ed or Dad, they had to call him the Sheik. That's living the gimmick, my friend. You know, so you know, and there are YouTube videos out there of the Sheik and his promotion. Trust me. None of them is going to set anyone's house on fire as far as work rate or anything like that. But it's just fun nostalgia to look at. You know, that they had a gimmick match up there called a shark cage match, where they literally put two guys in a shark cage.
And it Have you ever seen one?
Oh my God, it's just completely awful. Yeah, just completely awful.
So there's a good one. There's a good one for you, Jeff. Worst gimmick match of all time. Certainly that's because was it Mark Lewin or it was Don Kent versus Chief J Strongbow in a shark cage match? I got to tell you, I'd rather eat pineapple on pizza from Domino's than have to watch this match. But Jeff, crossing my desk right now, we have breaking news, Jeff. Auburn football legend and former professional wrestler Kevin Green has passed over at the age of 58 years old.
That's pretty young. Legendary run with the Steelers, with the Rams, before he had his foray into wrestling. Wow, that's too bad. And any cause of death?
They didn't. So I quickly, as the article, somebody sent me the article, I quickly looked. I did not see anything. 58 is young, though.
I'm not sure if he was a Hall of Fame football player or not. He was very close if he wasn't. So anyway, getting back to, so yeah, the Shark Tank or the Shark Cage death match was completely horrible gimmick. So he had horrible matches, but let's be honest, in Bugsy McGraw's book, he was the guy that gave Bugsy his first break. He was a guy that was known to give guys their first bit of experience and then let them go out after they had a little something to put on their resume and go out and make their way in the wrestling world. So he was extremely generous with helping guys get a break in the business. I don't know if he was extremely generous though when it came to paying the boys. He was extremely generous paying himself, whether that was deserved or not, because he
all made promoters a ton- are, aren't they?
Yeah,
aren't they?
He made a ton of fucking right. money. There's no question about that.
Yep. Jerry Jarrett comes to mind when you say that. Jerry Jarrett, I'll have a multi-room mansion on a hill. You enjoy the pork and beans.
Yes, and the can of tuna fish.
Yes, exactly.
And I remember, as far as Abdullah the Butcher goes, I remember the first time as I was just getting exposed to the business, Dave Meltzer put out his Who's Who in Pro Wrestling book. Do you remember that?
Still have it, I think.
Yeah, so do I. And I remember I'm leafing through it. And one of the great things about the Who's Who book was this is the first time I'd seen photos from the Japanese magazines. And the Japanese magazines were well known. They'd have pictures of guys outside the ring. And, you know, it would be a more humanizing portrayal of the guys. You know, you'd have Hulk Hogan at home or Ric Flair at home. And to me, it made it more interesting. And then you get matches that weren't covered in the After magazines or Wrestling Review, like photos of stuff like, you know, because there were territories that, let's be honest, they really didn't cover as well as they did the New York up in New York. So you see like Ted DiBiase in Houston or Ted DiBiase in New Orleans in an action shot. And that was kind of cool. But as I'm scanning through the Who's Who, and just for those of you that aren't familiar with that, because I know we do have some younger fans, the Who's Who book that Meltzer put out came out I want to say 86, late in the year in 86, maybe early 87. And it gave depending on the guy, it would give maybe a couple paragraphs, maybe 2-3 paragraphs on their career. It would list major titles they had won. It would talk about, you know, last year in the Observer voting, he was ranked number 22 in the world. He won Best Babyface. And then they would talk about maybe like who trained him. And, and give Dave quick synopsis. This guy is he's a great gimmick, but he's not known as a strong worker, you know, that kind of thing. And it would give what Dave, at least at the time, thought was their real name. Of course, there was a few. I remember he messed up on Ivan Koloff's name. He put Ivan Koloff's real name as Red McNulty, right. which was one of Ivan's original gimmicks, but it wasn't his real name. But so anyway, so I get to Abdullah the Butcher and I'm looking and I'm reading about Abdullah the Butcher. And I see that his name is Larry Shreve. I remember thinking, Larry? Abdullah the Butcher is a guy named Larry? Like, what the fuck? And it just, I remember, what is it? Good Lord, 34 years ago now. And I still remember like reading that and going, are you kidding me? Larry? And this guy named Larry. And, at the time, he was still a main event guy in tons of different territories. A guy
was good at this stage that we can say.
Yeah, no, he looks Abdullah good. The Butcher actually had one of my top 100 matches of the decade in a match he had. I want to say at the Fort Worth Stockyards with Bruiser Brody. It's the match. I can't remember if we covered this match or not, Barry. If we did, it was one of the first episodes. It's the one where Mark Lawrence jumped up on the TV truck and it said, I can't see I couldn't see the ring, so I had to jump up on the TV truck. They're now back by the dressing room, and he's calling the action from the top of the TV truck, and they're just going literally all over the building. And it was chaos, pandemonium, and it was a lot of fun. Nobody was doing any drop toe holds or anything like that, but it was just a fun all out brawl. And speaking of that, I had a chance. I want to say. Maybe the first or second, I might've seen him face El Gran Apollo because I seem to recall he was in maybe the Sunrise Musical Theater in that 1980 run with El Gran Apollo. Because didn't El Gran Apollo just come off of having his head shaved by somebody? Maybe like Buzz Sawyer or something like that.
I think it might've been, but I forget, but yeah, he did. I don't know if he did shave his head. I don't know if that was I don't remember if that was part of an angle or not.
And so anyway, so I think but I did see him, me and my boy Craig Halleck went down to the convention center February of 88 or 87 in a card that featured the return of our man, the Tennessee Stud, Ron Fuller, to Florida.
That's right.
Because Ron worked the card and the Sheik worked Bruiser Brody. And I think literally they were in the ring. They did the introductions. The bell rang and Brody went across the ring and the Sheik jumped out of the ring and they started to just run around the building. And the crowd just followed him all around the building. And the Sheik, after like maybe 5 minutes, went into the dressing room and locked the door, and Brody started kicking at the door. And yeah, and you know, for a one-off, it was a lot of fun. I remember, I'm sure it was no technical brilliance to be sure, but it was a lot of fun. Even though at this point the Sheik would have been, geez, like probably like close to 60 years old.
90. And, 92.
Yeah, exactly. Actors, exactly.
As I look. So what's interesting,
come from the retirement home to work the show.
they did, you know what? They let him out right after dinner, and he made it over, and yeah, it came with a candy striper from the retirement home. So this was, it's funny you say that too. That was Ron Fuller's one-off on Miami for the first time in over 10 years. And he wrestled Kareem Muhammad, Ray Candy, that night. And there is videotape out there of both of those matches that was shot by a fan, the same guy that shot Brody and Luger in a cage, which is Craig Cohen, good friend of Howard Brody. But I do have this videotape somewhere, Jeff, if you want to see it. It's Fuller. I think those are the only two matches. It was Fuller, Muhammad, and then Sheik and Brody, and that was it.
So good time. So yeah, so this match, the Sheik and Abdul the Butcher from Japan, 1980, it's a fun brawl, tons of blood for those of you that are into that kind of stuff. And it happens relatively quickly and early in the match because it's not, like I said, it's not a 60-minute Broadway. But Barry, would you agree though? A fun match. It's not any kind of, you know, anything that's going to win match of the decade, but it was a fun, goofy 10 minutes. Would you agree?
It was. You know what? There was a purpose to this match, and I think it succeeded in what it was trying to do. Let me tell you a funny Abdullah story, though. Abdullah is, as you know, as probably everybody knows, he's the ultimate carny. He is.
No.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Where all wrestlers are carny, Abdullah is, he's probably lord and creator of the carnies.
Abby, can I shake your hand? That'll be $5. Thank you very much.
That'll be $5. And that's Mr. Abdullah the Butcher. Exactly. Which he likes to be referred to. But years ago, and this was a story that Jody Simon, I think Jody being the son of the great Malenko and Jody Malenko, which, you know, had great success over in Japan. But he told this story, and I believe he told it publicly. So his first tour of all Japan, and I think he was over there with his brother. I think it was Dean and Joe Malenko. And they were on the bus with Abdullah. And again, this was their first time in Japan. You know, and these aren't two guys at this stage that had really worked a lot of territories, very small in what they had done. And Abdullah's on the bus with them, and Abdullah, I guess, is talking to Jody, and they strike up a conversation, and one thing leads to another, and he winds up selling Jody, and it was either a Louis Vuitton or a Halliburton type of case, like a suitcase. And I think it was Louis Vuitton. And so he sells it to Jody. And Jody gets, I guess, you know, gets back to the hotel. He's got the suitcase and he starts to put his stuff in it. And I guess as he's packing the suitcase, it literally falls apart. And it
was it a Louis Vuitton he purchased on the streets in New York City by any chance?
He purchased it on the streets of somewhere, and it was about as fake a Louis Vuitton. But I think as Jody was telling me the story, he goes, so it didn't say LV, it actually went VL, like even the initials were reversed. And he goes, it fell apart. So I went to Abdullah and I was like, you know, you sold me this, it's fake. He goes, I want to get my money back. And Abdullah gave him the response like, you just learned a valuable lesson, kid. It was like one of those kind of things. Jody Simon, also one of the tougher human beings that literally at that stage could have had his way with Abdullah 50 ways over. Probably decided not to stay in the good graces of Giant Baba, who was the promoter. But I just thought that was funny. And when Jody Simon was telling me this story, and this is probably some 30 to 35 years later, still angry about it. You can tell.
He wants his fucking money back.
Still not quite over it. Yeah.
And my fucking money back.
So, that's it.
So anyway, all right. So we will post a link to this this match, which is a lot of fun. This is not going to be a regular occurrence here on Breaking Kayfabe about it and Bray, but we figured it's the holiday season. We'll do something a little different. We had never done anything featuring the original Sheik, and certainly a guy who definitely belongs up there in the history of the business. Just not only for one of the, you know, I would say he's got to be one of the top three or four gimmicks of all time. I mean, just for the length and breadth Absolutely. Of his career. The amount of money the guy made, whether he was a promoter or not, he was always a guy that was being brought into different territories to work matches because he meant he meant money at the box office. There's no question about that. So we'll post a link to that so you can check it out. Get a look at the original Sheik versus Abdul the Butcher. Okay, Barry, now I think it's time for us to light up a nice stogie. You can light up something else if you prefer, Mr. Rose. And we'll get a nice little glass of something of a cocktail or a mixed drink variety and have a little sit down with our friend, the Tennessee stud, Ron Fuller. Let's go to that interview now. Barry, it is the holiday season. And in this holiday season, in the spirit of the holiday season, especially here in 2020, I think what we need to do is we need to have a little Christmas toddy, sit down by the fireplace, talk with a man that was a wrestler, a promoter, a booker, an owner. Who can we possibly reach out to, Barry? Do you know anybody that fits all that criteria?
And Jeff, you're forgetting too, we're talking about a best-selling author.
Yes, best-selling author. Well. Former owner of a hockey team, which always perks my interest.
Did he ever win the Nobel Peace Prize?
No, never did.
Okay.
It's not Jimmy Golden. Okay. We've eliminated Jimmy Golden.
Bunkhouse Buck. All right. I got that.
Check. Is it Robert Fuller?
I like Robert Fuller. No, I don't think it's
a good guy,
Fuller.
But it's not. Yeah. Robert. No, it is the true. I listened to the show this week, so I know to say this. It is the true Tennessee stud riding up on old Lightning. It's our friend Ron Fuller. Ron, it's a pleasure. How you doing today, buddy?
Oh, gosh, guys. So glad to be with you all. It's been a pretty rough year for everybody. And I think at this time of year, we ought to have a few laughs, man.
Yeah. So we're going to just sit by the old fireplace. In lieu of the learning tree, we're going to sit by the fireplace this week, Ron.
Cool.
And we're going to talk about some stuff. So I reached out to Ron, told him what one of my general topics was going to be on this discussion. As anyone that listens to this show, to any of the Arcadian Vanguard shows, know that we recently lost one of the great wrestling minds in the history of the business, Pat Patterson. And Pat, of course, was openly gay. And so I reached out to the stud. And the first question I wanted to ask Ron was, Ron, if you know of, did you have, and I want anyone names, did you ever have a wrestler that worked under your employ that was gay?
I had to think about that a little bit because I've had quite a few wrestlers wrestle for me.
Well, while you're thinking about that, I'm going to tell you why I asked. Because, of course, you know, a situation like that in a wrestling locker room it's known for being a very macho place. You know, guys kind of feeling their oats. And you wonder how someone who is sort of like the boys know that they're gay, how they might fit into that locker room or might not fit in, as the case may be. So as you're thinking about that, do you think that in the Knoxville territory, since that's where we are in the studcast now, do you think that would have been a problem if there was a wrestler that had been gay, how they would have fit in with the locker room?
I don't think it would have been a problem. I never had a problem with gays. They're just like everybody else. They have a place here too. I don't think so. I think it would have a lot to do maybe with how the guy at the top, how the owner, how the guy, the booker, some of the people that are in charge there, how they handle it. And I think the boys in the business kind of watched for telltale signs of how to treat people. And you know, a lot of wrestlers had pretty broad opinions, but they didn't express them that often. And I don't think it probably was a problem anywhere much in the wrestling business. You know, you obviously had Jim Barnett. He kind of set the pace and they set the tone for a lot of young wrestlers that came through and a lot of other guys with how you treat those type of people. And I don't think it would have been a problem.
Well, I guess, and I don't mean to interrupt you. Is it a case of, well, certainly in the case of Pat Patterson, who was out in California for years making money, or Jim Barnett, where he promoted, whether it's Australia or in Georgia, he had a history of making money. Is it just like anybody else? If, you know, whether you're red, black, blue, green, whatever, if you're making the promotion money, your position's pretty safe in the company.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, and he was a tremendously talented wrestler. I mean, you'd be honored to have him in your crew, you know, because of his ability. And I got to thank you and Barry, you know, for I had the opportunity to meet him. I never met him until I think it was the last fall, not this past fall, but the fall before when my brother and I did one of your programs and he was there. I had an opportunity to go I actually went down and he sat down at the end of the room, and I made a point of going and introducing myself to him because I respected what he had done in wrestling enough that I wanted to meet him. And I was impressed with his attitude and with his personality. I wasn't surprised a bit with him being the type of guy he was and what he accomplished.
Yeah, and that was a question that I was going to ask you if your paths had ever crossed before. But one guy that you did work with, I believe, in Continental was Chris Colt. And Chris was, I think he was maybe the first openly gay wrestler. I know a lot of people do credit Pat, but even as a kid, I think we had heard that Chris was was openly gay. Did that ever present an issue? And I realized when it came to Chris that, you know, I don't think his sexuality was ever an issue. I know that he was a wild man on every other level, but, you know, what was it like having Chris in a locker room?
Great. I mean, you wouldn't, there was no way anybody would have had any idea he was any different than anybody else. Then, you know, I assume if a guy that is of that persuasion is in your dressing room and he's making the advances or he's doing something wrong, obviously the booker would certainly tap him on the shoulder and take him off to the side and have a conversation with him. And, you know, I believe that it would make it difficult for him. I think Chris fit in really, really well. Never had any problem. Never had anybody say anything about it. You know, wrestlers they think well of pretty much everybody. And you know, sometimes we're in a difficult sport and a lot of bad people in wrestling, you know, tough people, but, you know, not a lot of bad people, you know. So, Chris fit in very well. You would have never had any idea that he was that way.
So let me ask you, I'm going to take it sort of in a slightly different direction, but with the same general topic. So what about when you have a wrestler, and I know you did in Continental, you had Adrian Street there. And Adrian Street did an effeminate gimmick, but of course he was well known as a terrific shooter and not somebody certainly to be trifled with at all. But when you have a gimmick like that, I'm just strictly talking about his gimmick. Is that something that the guys have a problem working with? Or is it, again, a case of, well, if we're making money, I'm happy with it?
Oh, you know, the guys if you were making money, they were happy with it. And when we did a lot of things with Adrian that really pushed his gimmick for him, it helped him push his gimmick. Gosh, we had Wendell Cooley. Wendell Cooley is a great athlete, good looking guy, a tremendous wrestler. A young guy, and he worked program with Adrian, and oh gosh, toward the end of the program, Adrian whacked him around, and I think Linda hit him in the head with something, and he went down, and Adrian put a dress on him and put a lipstick on his face, and I mean, we did some pretty crazy things. We let Adrian do his thing, and Adrian, I'm not so sure about Adrian, to be honest with you, sometimes. I mean, Adrian always... he would always mess with me a lot. He would come and find me in the dressing room, getting dressed to go to the ring or whatever. And he'd walk up by me and he'd run his hand down my leg and he'd say, "Oh, you're looking so good, Ron." You know, and I mean, I was never sure about Adrian, you know, but obviously Linda, I mean, Adrian, it was a gimmick for Adrian and he worked it tremendously well. And he worked it in the dressing room. He's one of those guys that, you know, he did it from the time he arrived to the time he left the building. You know, it was his personality when it came time to perform.
Well, you know, I know, Ron, when you had Adrian on your Super Stud cast, there was the story, and it's a very famous picture in wrestling history where he went in full gimmick to where his dad worked in the coal mines in Wales.
Yeah.
And the look on the faces of the guys in the coal mines and Adrian standing there by his dad and his full gimmick regalia. And, you know, it just shows you that the guy was not afraid to live that gimmick. That's for sure.
He loved it. I think it became part of who Adrian was. And, you know, sometimes I was a little concerned that, hey, maybe it's more than just a gimmick, but you know, he was that good at it. And yeah, you're right. I mean, that is a classic picture with him and his father and all those coal miners with their faces all dirty, standing back there looking at him. Adrian is a unique individual, a great person. I love Adrian Street. I love his wife too, Linda. She's a great person too. And I was truly honored to have him work for me. But I will tell you this about Adrian. The first time I ever saw Adrian is he wanted to come into the territory. I'd never talked to him or anything. And he sent a message to me and he said, I want to send a tape and let you see the video. And so we were in a television studio in Dothan, Alabama, WTVY, where we recorded wrestling. And I took the tape up and it was about a 4-minute tape. And before the show ever started, and there was a production people, there's probably 6 or 8 production people around. And, you know, I said, hey, I want to see this tape. Can you put it on there? I want to check this guy out. And wow, you would have been amazed at that. That studio lit up, man, in that control room. They were like, God, Ron, who is this? Where is this guy from? And, you know, I said, hey, he's from England, man. You know, he's from across the big pond, man.
He was doing exactly what he meant to do, which was to provoke a reaction.
Absolutely. And boy, did he get it. I mean, what happened in that control room had a big bearing on me bringing him in. I saw those guys light up. They were like, wow, look at this guy. And then once I saw him make some wrestling moves, I was like, oh, boy. Yeah, and hell, it was a no-brainer. I said, heck yeah, I got a spot for this guy.
So one of the names you just mentioned, too, was the Wildcat, Wendell Cooley. So there's a guy that I've always felt, where I'm going to go with this, I'll let you know, but Jerry Stubbs to me seemed maybe one of the best wrestlers I ever saw that never made it big on a national level. And I know that he had a great run in Mid-South for Watts underneath the hood and certainly worked for you, but really was a guy that didn't get around, but I always thought he was just phenomenal. So in your opinion, Ron, again, you've been around professional wrestling now for over 50 years, really all your life, obviously. Who is the one guy, and I realize that that's probably going to be a tough question, but who is the one guy that you truly feel could have been, you know, a massive star? You know, it just could have been a really big deal, but for whatever reason, whether he wanted to homestead, whatever it was, just didn't get there.
Jeez, you know, there's been so many young guys. We dealt with a lot of young guys at Southeastern and Continental that were just getting their start. I had a young kid one time in 70, about the same time frame that we are in the Studcast now in 76, a kid named Rip Smith.
Oh, yeah.
I thought was just headed for stardom. I mean, you know, he was undoubtedly going to get there. And he kind of disappeared off the map. I never heard from him after he left. I never saw him anywhere else. I never heard anybody talk about him. But, yeah, there's quite a few guys that had extremely tremendous talent. I think Jerry's problem is Jerry didn't go to enough territories. He didn't make the runs. He didn't do the deal that most wrestlers do. We kept him so long in Continental and Southeastern and Pensacola, and he just only went to Watts, so far as I know. Other than that, you know, he didn't get out there and make that name for himself. And I think that's why he didn't become one of those major stars. He was underlooked because nobody knew about him. Very few people knew about him. And that was important. If you want to go in big time, you needed to be seen a lot of different places and you'd get your name out there and your reputation out there.
We had Jerry on, I'll say, Jeff, what was it, about a year and a half ago?
Yeah, probably about that, yeah.
And Jerry was really one of the more unique interviews. Jeff, was it pineapple and mayonnaise sandwiches that Jerry was eating? Is that what he said?
Horrifying, horrifying.
Horrifying. Pineapple and mayonnaise sandwiches.
Horrifying.
But hey, I can add a little bit of color on Rip Smith, on Irvin Smith. So he was an astounding athlete. He went to, I think it was USF, and was on the football team, was on the wrestling team, but he was a real football star, and he was only around for a couple of years. You had him in Knoxville. We saw him in Florida, which was where he was based out of. We didn't have him for too long, and I think after he left Knoxville, he went to work in Amarillo, West Texas, for the Funks, and I guess he did a few of these road trips, and he was with Ted DiBiase, and he finally, on one of those really long West Texas to New Mexico road trips, and I guess he had a temper, if I'm correct. I've heard that he had a temper.
Yeah, he was a little hot. He was a little hot-headed sometimes.
He flipped out and started cursing and said, I'm not doing this anymore. And he packed his bags and he quit, went back down to Tampa. And I still believe he's in the Tampa area to this day.
I'll be darned. See, I knew he disappeared, and I couldn't figure out why I've never heard of Rip anymore. I mean, the kid had tremendous talent. And he was obviously a great athlete. He was in that Paul Orndorff, you know, same type of, you know, same category as Orndorff, I thought. And being a football player, I never realized he went to USF. But, you know, I didn't even know that. But it makes sense now. Then there was a few guys that came through like that. Sylvester Ritter came to me in 19, just about the same time frame we're in now, 76. He's actually probably going to show up in 77. And he was, to me, like, wow, this guy's got it, you know. And we were, because Knoxville in that part of the country, it didn't have a lot of blacks that lived in that area. It didn't make sense to have a great black. We had Norvell. And Norvell was probably one of the few black guys that we had in there because we didn't have a big black population in that part of the country. But Sylvester came. He stayed with me probably 6 months. And I called Bill Watts. You know, and I told Sylvester, I said, Sylvester, I got a buddy that needs you, and he's got a spot for you. I never expected he was going to be the massive star he became, but I knew he had the talent and the ability, and obviously Bill saw it right away. And you never know about wrestlers. And Rip, that's good. That's, for me, that makes sense. I'll tell you what, the road beat the hell out of you as a wrestler. And,
Ron, you know what I got to tell you? When Barry was telling that story, you know who immediately came to mind? Have you heard the story about Jack Briscoe's last day wrestling?
No.
He was sitting in the airport, I think I want to say New Jersey, New York, and there's snow all on the ground. He's looking out the window. He's sitting with his brother, and he said, I'm catching the next flight that's going south. I don't care where. I'm done. And he just quit right on the spot. And, you know, they were already up there in New York. And he just decided, and when Barry was telling that story, that's the first thing that popped in my mind. Sounds like when Jack Briscoe said, I've had enough, I'm done. So,
when you think about that too, how many guys just basically said, Jack still could have gone for years. How many guys say, I'm done, it's over, and really never come back because Jack never did?
Yeah. And there's got to be hundreds of them that did that. You know, they walked away when they still had 6 or 8 good years remaining. Jack experienced everything, though. You know, Jack and I were pretty darn close because, you know, he took a liking to me, and I spent 4 years with him there in Florida. And what a tremendous athlete and a tremendous guy. And he had some horror stories, too, about, you know, the way he was treated before he became big time. Before he went to Florida and somebody took a look at him and said, hey, then we need to take care of him. And he had a great one that I always loved that he told me one time. I said, did you ever work in Tennessee? And he says, yeah, he did. He said, yeah, Ron, I did. I worked there for Nick a little bit, you know. And I said, how did that go? And he says, well, Ron, he goes, I went in there driving a Cadillac. And he says, I came out of there on a Greyhound. So, you know, I mean, Jack had all these experiences. I think it took Jack quite a while to get to that, where he needed to be in the business. And I think when you go that and you have to deal with those extremes, that it taints you a little bit. You at the end, you know, you don't want it. You still got all these horrifying and bad experiences that you went through trying to get off the ground. And then some of that, I think that makes a lot of guys want to leave before their time is really gone.
Well, before I ask Ron my next question, I do want to mention that since this is the holiday season, that if you go to tnstud.com, you can make inquiries about Ron's new best-selling book, Brutus, A Lion Running Amok in the Smoky Mountains, Ron.
Yeah.
Holy cow. It's like Jaws in the woods.
Yeah, that's a good way of putting it. You know, I mean, a lot of people are comparing it to Jaws. You know, I see that and I'm like, wow, you know, then wait a minute now. That's one of the greatest books of all time and certainly one of the greatest movies of all time. But I had myself a dream and gosh, man, it took 20 years for it to get into a book. But, you know, it's been an experience for me. This is my first time to do anything like this. And I'm finding out that it's a tough business. That author's thing is a big, it's a hard to get, it's a hard road to toe.
All I'll say is I completely understand what you're talking about. Yeah. So may I ask, Ron, if someone was to go to TN Stud and they have an interest in the book or your DVD collections, but if they wanted to get the book perhaps autographed by the Tennessee Stud himself, and they came from the good folks here at Breaking Kayfabe with Bowden and Berry, would that entitle them to a 1% discount?
Well, that's a great one, man. You guys are definitely entitled. I'll send both of you to you guys. My God. You know, I mean, this book, it's amazing. My reviews, I have so many. All my reviews are 5 stars. I've seen nothing less than 5. You know, and I'm around 40 reviews already, and they're all just, I read them and I'm like, wow, maybe I can write. You know, you never know when you do something like this, whether it's going to go or not. But, I got a book for both of you guys, man. So
you're a guy that's been basically a storyteller your whole life through wrestling. And so it's sort of a natural transition there to tell a story about Brutus. So, Ron, now getting back to the questions that we were asking, you know, we were talking about guys that never really reached their potential. You talked about Rip Smith and stuff like that. And, you know, this past week or so on the Studcast, at the time of this recording, at least, you were mentioning a very difficult position that you were in where you had someone that was working in your company that you had to terminate because that person had been drinking a little too much and it was affecting their performance, shall we say. So later on, and I know that you have said that you made your brother the quote assistant booker so that he could do the dirty work, which I thought was a very sharp move on your part, by the way. But did you find yourself as you moved into the 80s? And again, we want no names, but did you find yourself in a position as the owner where you needed to tap your brother on the shoulder and say, this guy we think has a problem with alcohol? And then, of course, it was the 80s. Did you get in a position where drugs became an issue where you needed to set somebody down and say, you need to get to find other work?
Yeah, especially in the 80s. We're in a time frame about 76 with the Studcast, and the drugs aren't there at that point. It just hasn't gotten there in society. And we didn't have that much. It was drinking, man. There was a few, you know, pill poppers. But some of those guys were way back in the 50s. My dad dealt with some of that with Mario Galento and guys like that way, way back. But in the 80s, it was a pretty much common problem. But Rob was no longer the key man back at that point in the 80s. That job went to Bob Armstrong.
I like a mannequin.
Yeah. So when Rob kind of worked, you know, and he did his trial and tribulations with me, and then me saying, Rob, that guy's got to go, and Rob, you got to talk to that guy. Then about 1980, early in 1980s, when we got into Pensacola, then Bob became my Rob. My Rob became Bob, and boy, Bob handled it great. You know, Bob was really, you know, about that, it was strictly business with Bob, and he was really on top of that. I mean, when I turned him on to, you know, having a conversation with a guy, he really took care of it in a way that
old Marine in him came out.
Oh, my goodness, man. And you know, he had guys saluting him.
Semper Fi.
Yes, sir. He's like, yes, sir, Bob. Yeah, he was great. What a wonderful guy Bob was. Oh my gosh, I miss him so badly. He was just a tremendous, tremendous guy, and a role model if there ever was one.
Yeah, and we talk. You know, this is something we talk about, and it's, I guess, sadly, we've been talking about this frequently. But as we lose our heroes, it becomes very difficult. You know, and certainly we're all getting older. You know, it's all natural. But at the same time, I know for myself, a lot of times, you know, like being able to interact with you or Jerry Briscoe or Steve Kern, it makes me a kid again. And even though technically, legally, I guess I'm not a kid, I do become that, you know, 14-year-old kid inside by this interaction. So it does become really difficult as we start to lose our heroes as they get older. So when I look at that, and I was going to say to you, whose death in the last few years has affected you the most? But I think you may have already answered that question.
Oh, yeah. I mean, and I've lost a lot of friends and a lot of guys that worked with me and for me. But Bob Armstrong was, to me, he was everything that a man, a real man should be. And wow, I just had such tremendous respect for him. He raised four sons that were just magnificent athletes. Credit to the sport, every darn one of them. And Bob was just it really did. I don't go to funerals. It's pretty, you know, I guess it's sad. I shouldn't even admit it, probably, but I didn't go to Eddie Graham's funeral. I didn't go to Dusty Rhodes' funeral. It's very, very difficult for me to deal with that. But I went to Bob's funeral. In fact, I got to say, you know, and I know this sounds bad, but he's the only wrestler's funeral I ever went to. We had a great relationship, he and I. And he did a great job like Rob did, man, when I said, hey, Bob, you need to take care of this. It's business. And boy, he was right on it. And I miss him. But, you know, we lose them so fast nowadays, it's ridiculous. I mean, you know, just like one on top of another, and you find out about one, and 3 days later, you hear about another one, and it's just sad. It's a sad deal.
Well, let me ask you, getting back to something you recently discussed on the Studcast, where you were talking about having to bring the person in and to terminate them because their drinking was getting to be a problem. So I'm curious, as a promoter, and you want to stay in the good stead of your fellow promoters, especially at that point in the NWA. So this particular person, let's just say they want to go, whether it's a different part of Tennessee, they want to go to the Carolinas, Florida, you know, wherever, Portland, and they want to get a recommendation for the promoter that's going out there, or the promoter. So say this individual wants to go to Portland. I'm just going to pull a name out of my hat there. And Don Owen calls you up and says, Ron, this guy wants to come in. What can you tell me about him? He's a good guy, good worker, hard worker. What can you tell him? Now, are you obligated, since you're part of the NWA, to sit there and say, well, there's something you need to know? Or do you kind of say, I'll let that guy find out on his own?
I've always been the type of guy that I would have to level with Don.
Yeah.
You know, I would, you know, you couldn't stand up for guys that couldn't stand up for themselves. And I just felt like, you know, this particular guy, I think he got the picture when I had the discussion with him. I don't think he would have ever asked for a recommendation from me, you know, after that. That really was an affecting thing for me. You know, I'm 28 years old at that point, and this guy's considerably older than me at this time. And, you know, and he's been a big star when I was in Florida with him. And, you know, he was the man. And, you know, it was a bad experience for me as a much younger guy and now in a position of owning a company to have to handle business. That particular kind of business wasn't a good thing. But, We parted friends. In fact, we had some great matches in the last 6 weeks that he was in the territory. Tremendous matches.
Gotcha. So we discussed, you know, at the earlier part of the conversation, we discussed what the locker room could be like. So I'm going to go in maybe a different direction right now, Ron. So on the days when the Tennessee Stud was single, which towns in the state of Florida would you say may have had the most attractive women? And I asked that because when I was younger, I guess, yeah, that's a given. But when I was younger, I traveled the state to see wrestling a few times. And especially I was 17, 18 years old. So I was, you know, hormones were raging. I was totally out of my mind. So I would actually pay attention.
As opposed to now.
Well, it's actually worse now, Jeff, right, to be honest. But I would notice the difference between say, Miami Beach and Fort Lauderdale, and then I was in Lakeland and St. Pete and et cetera. Was there a specific city that you might have looked around and you might have said, wow, there are some absolute, and I realized the whole state had beautiful women, but might there have been a specific city that you might have looked at and said, wow, there are just drop dead gorgeous women here?
I got it. I'd have to go back a little further than that, Barry. Actually, I was married the entire time I was in Florida. I got married just before I came to Florida. And we started in Florida, and I was married when I left Florida. But I got a real good look at Florida women when I went to the University of Miami. And I was like you, man. I had the raging. I'll give you an idea. I was so into the women that I went to Clemson my freshman year, and they had 8,000 guys and 800 girls. And I transferred after the first year because there was no women, right? And then I went to Miami, and I remember being taken by the coach. It was in the summertime. He was recruiting me to move from Clemson to transfer to Miami. And he took me into the student union at the University of Miami, and we shot some pool. And there was beautiful women. I think he set me up is what he did, because we shot pool, and the pool table was down on a lower level. And just up on the left-hand side of where the table was, there were four pretty girls there. And back in those days, it was miniskirt days, man, when they wore those short skirts. And we shot pool. I remember it was one of my favorite pool games of all time.
I cannot believe that a coach would do something of a deliberate nature like that.
Can you believe that?
I tell you what, man.
It was horrible, wasn't it? So, and then what made it really, they really took it to the next level is then he took me to his house, and he wasn't a particularly handsome guy, and his wife was unbelievable. I was like, wow. I said, I got to go to school here. This is where I need to be.
I remember when I was in college, I did a term paper for an English class, and they said, just pick a topic, do a term paper. And I did it on the recruiting of high school athletes by colleges. Mind you, this is like back in the early 80s. And there was an article I found that, and I know this is going to come as a stunning development to you, that at the University of Florida, they had these women that were called Gator Getters. They were assigned to the pool room, much like the ladies you mentioned, Ron, and their responsibility was to bring those recruits into the fold, if you know what I'm talking about.
Oh, I'm telling you, man. And that was going on back in those days, too. I was there from 67 to 70. And wow, gosh, man. I mean, they were everywhere, and they used them. They, you know, hey, you're here. You're going to be here for a weekend. You brought in recruits, and they would send the recruits to some of the players, you know, and they really liked me because I had a lot of women, right? And they would say, Ron, hook him up. Hook this kid up. Hook that kid up, right? And so I was like, well, okay, guys, if that's what you want. So recruiting, that must have been a great paper, man, because, you know, having been recruited out of high school, there's a lot of things that go on there. I wouldn't have been, but speaking of recruiting, I would have never gone to Clemson if I had gone there. I went and visited on a weekend, and it was spring break, so there's nobody on campus. And so, you know, I never asked about, is there, are the males and the females equally divided in number here? I didn't get to that type of thing. You know, because there was nobody on campus. So I really got cheated when I got recruited by Clemson. I wish I'd have gone on a different week, man.
Well, listen, Ron, I got, we're going to start wrapping up here soon. I have one more wrestling related question, and then I got two quick ones before you go. You know, you're talking about wrestlers that never quite reach their potential and such like that. And you think about the fact that there is just a little bit, it's maybe 10 years younger than you. There's like a whole generation that basically is gone because they worked that national schedule for the WWE, and whether it was just life on the road that broke those guys down, the travel, the injuries from working so many cities Yeah, these guys were working schedules where they go from Los Angeles to Boston, then back to Dallas, like in a 3-day period. And it was just insane, as opposed to the, you know, the travel schedule you talk about that you had in Knoxville was so much easier. And it was something that the boys really appreciated, was they were making good money, putting money in their pocket, and they weren't killing themselves on the schedule. So, you know, like when you were talking about that, of course, you know, you don't even have to mention like somebody like B.A., you know, Brad Armstrong. But then the guys that fell victim to all those other vices on the road, a guy that you work, you know, that worked for you, Buddy Landell, you know, yeah, was a tremendous talent that just fell victim to life on the road and all the things that ensue therein, you know.
A great example of how that worked. And this is my brother. I mean, he went through this. I mean, he survived the territory days. He went to WCW, he ended up in WWE, and he absolutely hated it. The schedule for those guys that you're talking about, that age group, was just absolutely murderous. You know, he just said, "Ron, it's just horrible." You know, I mean, he just never had anything good to say about all that travel. And I can understand that, having done some of that in 73 and 74 when I was going to St. Louis a lot. And I was just going to one town. I can't imagine what it was like to do it on a daily basis. And you're right. We probably lost a lot of good talent, disappeared because they couldn't take it. And that's got to be a harder life than you being home every night is amazing for wrestlers. And in Florida back in the day, you were home every night, but sometimes coming out of Miami, it'd be 4 o'clock in the morning when you got home, you know, so you weren't home very much, but at least you were home every night. And when the businesses got bigger and everything changed, you weren't home. And
think about it, Ron, you're on the road and you've had a match, and let's just say you're in the semi-main or the main event. You get back to the hotel because you're on the road. And you're so keyed up, it's hard for you just to go to your bedroom or your hotel room and just go to sleep because you're so keyed up. So that was the life on the road. They would take something, whether it's drinking or drugs, to get them down. But then the next morning, they got to catch a flight out and they need something to bring them up.
Yeah. And Rob always complained about, he said, "Ron, the worst part of it is," he said, "they want to put you on the first plane in the morning." Sure. "They want to get you to the town in time and they want to have that problem." So he says, you go to bed at midnight, 1 o'clock in the morning, and at 4 o'clock, you're up to get to that 6 o'clock flight. You know, it's like, he said, day after day, he said, I got to where I just hated the early mornings. I mean, you never got any sleep. So yeah, bad times. Money was big, but boy, the sacrifice that you,
the cost
was huge.
Yeah. So, Ron, you did a couple of shots up in the Northeast in the WWWF, which I remember. Was it Madison Square Garden or Boston that
Madison
you were in?
Madison Square Garden, yeah.
Gotcha. So if, let's say that Vince Sr. had offered you a contract and the money was good, but maybe it wasn't, you know, through the roof good, would you have accepted or would you have taken into account the travel schedule and the weather? You know, the weather in the Northeast can be brutal.
Well, I think back in those days, now this was 1973 when I went to Madison Square Garden and I was in business only, I had third year in business. That was a different territory then. It's hard to compare that with the WWE situation. They were in the Northeast, but you were still home quite a bit. I would have maybe taken a shot at it because it would have made myself a big name. You're in front of so many people when you work in those territories because the populations of those cities are so huge. It might have been good for me to have that opportunity.
Well, certainly you're also in the media capital of the
country,
too.
There you go. Well, I mean, when you work Madison Square Garden, you get a feel for it instantly because, you know, in Florida, you never had anybody, the photographers and all that stuff. When I went to Madison Square Garden, I spent an hour in a photo room, and I mean, it was full of photographers and writers and stories, and it was like, wow, you know, I got a feel for, wow, this is amazing what goes on up here. You know, we just didn't get that kind of deal in Florida, but you know, probably back in that day, I'll guarantee you, we were probably making as much money in Florida as what Vince's boys were making.
Sure. So, Ron, during this holiday season. We certainly appreciate you giving us your time. And so it's about time for the go home. But before we go, I don't know that we've ever asked you a couple questions. These are very quick and easy. There's no right or wrong answer. Well, actually, there's a right and a wrong answer, but we'll get to that in a second. On our group page, Breaking Kayfabe with Bowden and Barry, there are two topics, Ron, that are extremely controversial. So I'm going to ask you the two questions, Ron. You ready? Ron, you enjoy a good pizza now and again?
Oh, yeah. I eat a little pizza. Yeah, sure.
Okay. Do you think that pineapple belongs on pizza, yes or no?
Well, I'll tell you what. If you ask my son that, he would say, that's the only pizza I want to eat. I have a son that just eats pineapple pizza. And personally, I've never had a bite of it. I've never even tried one. Because
that's the right answer, Ron. That's the right answer.
Well, that's a true and honest answer, that's for sure.
Okay, second question. You ever get a chance, you're sitting at home with your lady and you pop in a movie or you catch a movie on HBO or something like that?
Yeah, I watch movies with my lady.
Okay. Have you ever seen Die Hard?
Occasionally, probably maybe one day a week. Once every 10 days, I'll watch a movie. In fact, I'm going to watch one when I get off of here. I'm already recording it.
What's that?
It's an old Nicolas Cage movie called Wind Talker about the World War II. Indians that created the code that really probably helped win us the war.
Absolutely. You know? Yeah, that's a very strong movie. My question to you, though, Ron, was, have you ever had a chance to see the movie Die Hard with Bruce Willis?
Oh, yeah. Okay. The original.
Sure.
The first one.
Great action movie. Do you consider that a Christmas movie?
I consider that to be a great movie. I don't care what time of year it is. You know, that's just a fantastic movie. And I know it was in the Christmas time. I remember it was a Christmas time theme, you know, of what was going on. But, geez, that had nothing to do with that movie, basically, you know, time of year. That movie had more high spots in it than one of the greatest matches I've ever seen.
So anyway, well, listen, Ron, we certainly want to wish you and your whole family a very happy holidays, Merry Christmas, Happy New Year, all that kind of stuff. Let's put 2020 behind us, what you say, my man, and move on to 2021 and better times.
Well, the same thing to you guys. Y'all have been so good, man, and I really enjoy being on with y'all. Y'all have a great Christmas as well. And by golly, undoubtedly, 2021 is going to be better than 2020. That's for sure.
For sure, my friend. Have a good one.
All right. Thanks, guys.
Barry, I don't know about you, but it is always a pleasure to talk to my friend Ron Fuller.
You know what? Ron is he is such a good guy. It's the way you just phrased that is 100% correct. That's all we did. We just sat around and we just bullshitted with Ron Fuller. And yes, you know, there's an adult cocktail, maybe some other stuff. You do mention stogies, Jeff. Have you ever smoked a cigar?
I believe I did one time and got sick.
I did. I think I did twice and I didn't get sick, but I wish I would have gotten sick. If you can smoke cigars and you enjoy them, more power to you, because I don't get
that. As I recall, it was not a Cuban. It might have been from Ecuador or something like that. So anyway, as we begin to wrap up this episode of Breaking Kayfabe with Bowden and Barry, Barry, I do want to mention, number one, that I got a recommendation from a friend of the show, Judy Steele. Our first mention of Judy Steele on this show. Judy is the sister of my friend's brother, Jeff Steele, and David Steele. And Judy came on our board. She's one of the lovely ladies that's part of our brothership group, which maybe we should change the name. Who knows? But anyway, Judy recommended that we check out this movie on HBO, a documentary called How Can You Mend a Broken Heart? The Story of the Bee Gees. I had a chance to watch it. And Barry, I know you have not had a chance to watch it yet. It is absolutely fantastic. You do not have to be any kind of fanboy for the Bee Gees. You can hate the Bee Gees. And this is a compelling story because it talks about how these guys, they started performing like when Barry was like 11 and Robin and Maurice, the two twins, were like maybe 6 or 7, for God's sake. They were on stage singing 3-part harmonies and stuff like that. It's absolutely amazing. They go over to England. They sing. They do the song. How Can You Mend a Broken Heart is one. Maybe Massachusetts is another. But they have a career where by, I want to say 68, maybe 69, they're a pretty big deal in England. I almost said Japan, in England, and a well-known singing group. They kind of have a schism in the group. The brothers start feuding with one another. They kind of hit the proverbial skids in the music industry, which that's not a good thing in the music industry. They go a few years, then they pop back up around 75, and they have a couple of pretty decent hits, top 40 stuff, nothing like mega success. And then, of course, the monolith known as Saturday Night Fever comes about. They are asked to contribute some songs. They contribute like five songs, which are just massive, massive top five hits. And then, of course, you know, it's funny, whenever you have that kind of success, there's always the backlash of the people that start hating you because you're that successful, and they never, ever want to hear another Bee Gees song again. So they begin writing songs for other groups. You know, they wrote for Dionne Warwick, for Barbara Streisand. Good Lord, their brother, Andy, their younger brother, who died tragically young, they did a bunch of songs for him that were top five hits. And so it's a really interesting look at their career. As I was telling Barry and our producer Lou before we started recording, the sad thing is that Barry is the only one left now. And as I was watching the end of this HBO documentary, it struck me a little bit like Barry has become what Kevin Von Erich is. He's the last of the remaining famous brothers. And the last thing that Barry says is that he would give all of the success up if he could have his brothers back. And, you know, it really touches you and grabs you in the throat. It's very heartfelt and sentimental. Go home to the show. But if you get a chance, How Can You Mend a Broken Heart is on HBO now. Barry, I hope if you get a chance, you will avail yourself the opportunity, because it's well worth a couple hours of your time.
I absolutely would see it, too. And I, you know, with the Bee Gees, too, we should say, too, they're Australian.
Yes.
But Miami was their home for years. I mean, they were part of the Miami and South Florida landscape for years. So I always felt that the Bee Gees were local guys, because they certainly were at that stage. And you know, Saturday Night Fever was such a juggernaut that how many of those songs that they performed were top 10 or number one hits, right? Yeah. It was just like an endless stream of songs that they had. So I absolutely will see it. I did pop, though, Jeff. You sent me a text. And you said, we have a Ralph Renick sighting in the Bee Gees documentary. And if you grew up in Florida or spent any time in the 1970s and maybe even the early 80s in South Florida, Ralph Renick was the Walter Cronkite.
Or Cronkite.
This is what happened when we have cocktails with the Tennessee Stud, right?
Yes, of course.
Yeah. But he was
Cartwright.
I yell Cartwright, but my name's Costanza. That's right. I yell Cartwright. But he was the guy in South Florida as far as newscasters go. And I think newscasters now, probably based off of the landscape in the world, they're interchangeable. They're a dime a dozen. I couldn't tell you anybody who's doing the local news in Philadelphia. And I've lived here for 15 years. But everybody knew the name of Renick and Bishop, you know, Dwight Lauderdale, all these guys growing up in Florida. So I will be watching this, Jeff. I'm deep into Ozark right now. I jumped into Ozark about a week and a half ago. I do an episode to maybe two episodes per day, and I am just about finished up with the second season, going to get into the third season. So when that's done, the Bee Gees documentary is the first thing I'm watching.
Okay, I'm going to hit you with a little trivia that I absolutely did not know. You mentioned that the Bee Gees were based out of South Florida for a lot of the, oh, let's say mid-70s through into the 80s. And Barry apparently still lives in South Florida. So who was the guy who convinced the Bee Gees to come down to South Florida and record the music for their album before Saturday Night Fever? Because he thought it would make for a good setting, and he thought they'd get some positive musical inspiration before they started recording the album. What famous artist, I will say, that has been mentioned within the last five episodes here on Breaking Kayfabe, convinced the Bee Gees to move to South Florida?
Eric Clapton.
Yes. And I saw that. Was that a guess, or did you know that?
So can I tell you that
Sure. They
recorded one of their albums at his house in Golden Beach? So yes, that's how I knew.
461 Ocean Boulevard. That's where they stayed.
There you go.
That's where they stayed while they were at Criteria Studios, I think it's called. And Yeah, so Eric Clapton's the reason the Bee Gees were on Saturday Night Fever. So you can give him credit or blame, whichever you feel like you need to do. So anyway, as we get ready to go, I do want to make one mention of something Barry and I discussed without getting too maudlin or too sentimental. You know, for most people, the holiday season is a season of, you know, your family and you get together, you have good times and good remembrances. But let's remember that there are also people that struggle during the holiday seasons for one reason or the next. And so we want to say that, you know, as Barry and I are want to say, that the Brothership is a group that, you know, it's a community effort. And, you know, we had somebody recently on the group talk about some struggles they were going through. And I was very, very happy to see that, geez, must have been 30 people reached out and said, look, if you need to talk about what you're going through, please don't hesitate to reach out to me. I'm happy to talk with you and just listen. And so for those of you that are celebrating the holidays and happy that you're here, like me, after the year I've had, Barry.
Yeah.
You know, there are those that are like that. There are also those that struggle, that are going through personal issues. And we want to let you people know that we are with you. We feel for you. We are here for you. And so do not hesitate to reach out to either Barry, myself, Lou, or anybody in the Brothership if you're having a bad day. And so that being said, Barry, I will wish you, sir, a happy holidays. And anything else before we do the go home, my friend?
No, Jeff. So next week, we have a
that's right. Yes,
we got an action packed show, right?
We have a special announcement of a guest that's going to be with us. A guest, Barry. I will just do this as a lead in. A guest that has been at one of the CWF Legends Fan Fest. If I was it the first or second one, Barry?
It was the first one, Jeff.
Okay. Yep. So why don't you, with a little Tiffany, little drum roll, announce to our audience who we will have on the show next week?
Absolutely. We will be having, Jeff, a guest. It's a female. It is somebody that has never done a podcast interview or had a conversation on a podcast ever. We are getting the virginity, the podcast virginity of Lady Maxine, Mad Maxine. She has recently, over the last couple of years, written a book. It's now available via Amazon, or you can contact her directly. But it's a book about her training with the Great Moolah.
Or the Fabulous Moolah.
Yeah, the Great Moolah, Fabulous Moolah.
It was the Fabulous Moolah and the Great Muda. I think they cross-trained her.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But yeah, but crusty old Moolah. Yeah. But yeah, she and you know, she's not the biggest fan, but this was a fun conversation, and we're very excited that she's going to be joining us next week.
Yeah, and I will tell you that this is not somebody who is just a trailer park schlum that got into the wrestling business. This woman is smart. She has she worked on a genome project. I don't know if she's got a doctorate, but wow, she's very intelligent. And it's a very interesting conversation. So we hope you will tune in next week for that conversation with the Lady Maxine, Mad Maxine. I don't know if she still has the mohawk or not, Barry. I think she's finally let it grow in. So, not working the gimmick anymore, but that's the way it goes. So on behalf of our producer, sweet Lou Kippelman, and my co-host, Barry Rose, Lord Barents, I will say, because I forgot last week, that Breaking Kayfabe, Lou is happy right now. Breaking Kayfabe with Bowden and Barry, a production of the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network. We do not just stick to wrestling, although we kind of did this week, Barry. And we will see you next week. Happy holidays to one and all.